I love how Lindsay described it in the documentary. She's like, emotions are like the tide. They come in, but they'll eventually go back out. And what often is, right, we hear this, especially in negotiating, don't be emotional about it, because then logic flies out the window and you're just like, I gotta buy that car because I just feel so good around it, ignoring that it's a terrible financial decision.
I'm that way about tech equipment. Yeah. It's like, no, this would make me awesome and go into the future. My wife's like, no, we have 5 kids. We need to go to Sam's. You don't need to buy a $500 router. Welcome to the How Leaders Think podcast, the show that transforms you by renewing your mind and giving you new ways to think. I am your host, Kenny Lang, and with me today is the Preston Zeller. He is the founder of Zeller Haus, and it's spelled H-A-U-S, which sounds awesome. Reminds me of Magnolia Pancake House in San Antonio. And right now, I want some apple cinnamon pancakes, but I'll hold off until the end of the show. It is an AI-powered biblical guidance app helping believers access scripture-based wisdom for real-life challenges. With 15-plus years of scaling high-growth tech companies, including a cloud guru and Zoom info. So he's probably sold your info. You can send your hate mail somewhere else. He now pioneers responsible AI integration in ministry, a space where 57% of Christians express skepticism about technology. I can believe that, and I honestly think 57 is probably low. His film, The Art of Grieving, chronicles his year of painting 365 works following his brother's sudden death from a fentanyl overdose. Welcome to the show, Preston.
Kenny, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
I am excited to have this conversation. We had a really fun first interaction. I have no reason to believe that this will be anything less than stellar and fun. So tell me today, Preston, what is on your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think you summed it up well with my intro there. I think what I'm after is, so Zeller Haus is my venture studio, and that's where I'm exploring different use cases for AI. Of course, putting out different products like Psalm Log, so that's the biblical guidance app. And then just finding out where like, again, the best kind of like, not just ethical, yes, for sure. We should all be using AI ethically. Hopefully we're not just creating hacking programs. But my two main passions are productivity. How do I get, you know, help professionals and companies get more productivity and insights out of the usage of AI? But then also there's a faith-based component there for me too. And, you know, based on, of course, my grief work, it's also how I'm just able to like improve the human experience, I think, in general. And we've all gone through or will go through something that makes you kind of like step back from the things you think define you, like all the title and the money and what the world says is the measure of you, the house you live in, the car, all that stuff, and go, who am I as a person? And I know we both have kids. What do my kids think of me? How am I treating my spouse? And so like all those things are the human component is vastly more component. Sorry, not it's vastly more important than just like the money. Who cares about the money? Yes, we want money. That is how the world works. But if that's your primary driver, I think it's going to push you into a form of living that doesn't really suit anyone but yourself, you know?
Right. There's a lot there to unpack. I would agree, but I think all of us go through a period where money's like the focal point. A lot of times it's if you grew up not having it or not having as much as you thought, or you had friends or saw people who had quite a bit. Even my kids are like, oh, so-and-so's rich or has this. Yeah. And in my head, I want to go, it's like, do you know where we live? Like, I'm not saying that we have a mansion and we're not Elon over here by any stretch of the imagination. But I was like, do you realize like how fortunate you are? And you and I, we had a really good talk about grief in our first call. And I think grief is one of those things that can really change your perspective on way more than just the situation it's generated from or the grief is coming from. And so what it sounds like is you've had several key life experiences that have given you new perspectives on more than just a singular moment, a singular relationship, or period of life. It's really started to shape how you look at a bunch of other things. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I believe grief inevitably does that, right? I mean, let's say you initially, and I'll specify too, like grief in the sense of loss of life, because there's lots of forms of grief that get really just glossed over in the totality of life, right? But yeah, eventually when you make some headway in growing around your grief, it allows you to zoom out a bit from the loss, from that and your relationship with that person, and go, okay, well, they're not coming back. Here's what it starts to mean and how I function in other parts of my life. And based on what you kind of decide there, though, I think for most people, it's going to push you into more humility and empathy, because you realize, mm-hmm. hey, I can't make my problems the pinnacle of every situation that I'm into, but I also comparing the magnitude of what I'm going through to someone else's kind of issues they're going through in life also isn't even a fair measure, because you're not that person. And ultimately it's you're having to deal with the situation in front of you. And so I think that's another kind of pitfall we can get into is, oh, well, that my loss is worse than that one, or their loss is worse than mine. Uh-huh. And then you just diminish the whole thing.
Yeah. No, I think that's really important. And it may have been our first call where we talked about the race to victimhood, which I think is something plaguing society at mm-hmm. large, but maybe more so here in the US or Western cultures. What could you elaborate more on what you have found is maybe the current thinking or prevailing wisdom around whether it is grief specifically, but even just how our perspectives are shaped and informed? Because I would contend there's just a supreme lack of awareness. Like, we don't think about what we think about. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you've gotten some real insight on that and been able to notice what, you know, how different people are processing that, and maybe the common wisdom isn't serving us so well.
Yeah, well, you said it well, this whole like race to victimhood, right? And I mean, there's a lot of concepts and within that, right? So it's like forgiveness. What does that even mean? How does bitterness form? It's usually lack of forgiveness. Ooh. And then based on sort of how you even view forgiveness will enable you to either move forward in your life or to hold a grudge or to live and revisit trauma in an intentional way, because it justifies you sort of acting in a modality of life that,
wow,
that like the pain is the fuel for entitlement versus growth. And this isn't just like my observations. Even like in the process of my documentary, I talked to different art therapists, and one in particular who was featured in the documentary. And then I also used to do grief commission paintings. I just would talk to a lot of people going through grief before I got to an actual commission, and just seeing where they are at. But if everything kind of boils down to this thing hurt me so bad that now I'm going to use it to go then force everyone to just see my point of view, regardless yeah. if it's right or wrong, then we're just going to constantly be talking past each other and not being able to be in a form of empathy, unless like it's someone who went through that exact thing, which is, I guess, not normally the case. So I hope that's all kind of making sense there, but that seems to be definitely an issue. And if you haven't like gone through anything, I think it's just hard in general. And by not anything, you know, I mean, something that just kind of that makes you stop and reconsider, hey, am I kind of approaching life in the most human way possible, where it's not just about me?
Yeah. That's Which you never wish those moments on anybody, but they are so... I've not met anybody I really respect or feel has what I teach, and it comes from a book called The Only Leaders Worth Following by Tim Spiker. And in his research, they found that the two attributes that accounted for 77% of what makes a leader effective, and I think there's all sorts of leadership, not just in the business world, but but it was being inwardly sound and others focused.
Mm.
I've not met anybody who I would consider to embody those attributes who hasn't gone through something that just overwhelmed their senses and rocked their worldview in a negative way that they had to process through.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate that we're wired that way. I guess humans we're hard-headed. But you mentioned forgiveness, which I don't think a lot of people pair forgiveness and grief together, because they're like, well, this happened to me, and whether it is somebody who is like a loved one, such as your brother who passed away, it's like that wasn't something done intentionally to you, but there is grief. But how do you see and what have you come to learn about how forgiveness and grief interact with each other in the processing?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, few things there. When you're going through the grieving process, you're going to be looking for someone to blame. And I think grief from loss of life, from death of somebody, is in particular interesting in that regard, because you want to blame the person who died, but they're not here anymore. So then you got to go to somebody else. So in my case, that was my sister-in-law. And part of that was because, like, you know, the drug usage was in the mix of his life for a long time. So it was like, well, how could you let this happen? All this kind of thing. And so thinking she was somehow more accountable for that. And when ultimately my brother was just on a path of destruction there. Don't get me wrong. He did good things in life. He served in the military and served well and other things. But at the end of the day, when that loss happens, you could blame medical professionals. It's probably a pretty big one. There's a lot of military taking their life every day because they're not well cared for, a lot of PTSD. So, okay, maybe you blame the institution of the military or the VA, whatever it is, but you're going to look for somebody to blame. And again, ultimately, those things don't bring them back. I've had to learn a lot about forgiveness in the sense of what it really is. And in essence, and there's a huge biblical parallel in this for me, in that it's like I have to submit my sort of entitled desire for retribution to Jesus and relinquish that. But the other thing, which is I think one of the worst euphemisms we have in culture, Kenny, is forgive and forget. Well, for one, you don't voluntarily forget anything. That's like basically an impossibility unless I put you through like shock therapy. And the other thing is forgetting doesn't actually help you, because there are legitimately people or circumstances that are not in your best interest to go remain around. If you're in a physically or emotionally abusive relationship, forgetting that and continuing to submit yourself to it is not a good idea. But also forgiveness in that context could very well mean that, like, you are letting go whatever you feel like should be like, I need to exact revenge and I'm going to move on with my life, and however you think you think about that. But again, you know, that where you don't, and this is sort of like bitterness or lack of forgiveness is like drinking poison expecting the other person to die,
right?
Or rolling the boulder on a hill and it rolls back on you instead of dropping down and crushing the person. And so I think one of the pretty good sayings within the world is forgiveness is for you, not the other person.
Right.
Just because you forgive doesn't mean they're going to change, and you can't control that person at the end of the day anyways. And that goes from business circumstances. Like, you're going to have a disagreement with your boss, with your co-founder, with someone who reports to you, whatever it is, of course, your spouse. And so, man, if you hold on to those things, you'll see every one of us has probably met someone who's in their 60s or 70s who just, you bring up a person or situation and it's like their face changes and they have this long story about how they were wronged, and it hits into something inside you. So anyways, living in that, it's like when you find yourself ruminating on that situation, what you would have said, how you would have said it, how you would have zinged him back, all those things, that's a good opportunity to go, I don't think I've forgiven this person the way I thought I did. And also realizing that forgiveness is not a one-time thing. You may have to continually work on that. And that was a thing that I didn't realize until probably the past couple of years, like, to continually revisit forgiveness of a certain person in a certain situation and continue to relinquish that it wasn't like I just dropped the suitcase off in the middle of nowhere and there it is. Anyways.
Yeah. That's the grief comes in waves, but I think the need for forgiveness comes in similar waves as well. It's a choice. You said something interesting that struck me about control.
Mm.
And I wonder if some of the, whether it's the anger, the grief, the bitterness, the unforgiveness, and I think we might could bridge over to the AI topic as well, because I am interested in that mm-hmm. intersection, because I don't get to talk to a whole lot of people who are thinking through that in the world of Christendom. Mm-hmm. But do you think a lot of the anger, the grief, the frustration, the unforgiveness is just wrestling with the sudden awareness of how little control you actually have?
Well, so the understanding of grief I've come to is it's, or not grief, but anger, is it's the most out of control thing you can feel. Because you're in an attempt to control things, you're going to punish everyone and everything around you. Mm-hmm. And so, but that's not what it's labeled as. So it's like, okay, I could be angry, but if I act out my anger everywhere, that's a different thing. And so what mm-hmm. I think you can tend to see in yourself or in other people is instead of them processing that anger and trying to and working through it, it becomes an acted out behavior that then says, hey, I'm angry over this thing, and if you don't sort of come along on the ride for me, then you're gonna be torn up like a twister in my wake.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I don't even, who's that gonna win over anyways?
Yeah.
So, and again, I think going back to like the grief thing, when it's like, hey, I'm going to objectify these things that I am angry about over the loss on this person, you're going to end up beating that person up, whether it's internally or externally. And that's, I don't know what benefit that is. Again, it's not going to bring the person back. And even the things that have been done to you, talking about victimhood, it's not going to change those circumstances either. What in the past could you possibly change about what's been done to you? And I'm not saying everything is easy to move through either. That's not the point.
Right.
It's just the how are you turning that into an opportunity to grow? And that was really kind of the point of the documentary, was to just share my experience and how I was trying to grow through that initial process of grief and feel the things I was feeling. For sure, I used painting and abstract art as a tool for that. And that's kind of art therapy, and all the forms of it are there for that. And whether it's painting or drawing or anything like that, you can use that to like express and work through these emotions. Again, instead of necessarily holding on to it in a modality of now everyone needs to be sort of punished to share in the sort of victim mentality that you might have. So I think it's like stagnation versus growth is maybe two ways of thinking about that.
Yeah. I think a lot of people get frustrated when something like that overwhelms their senses and is such a shock that it's not a gradual process, right? Like, you know, death can be very, very sudden and shocking. And I do think that there is we feel the loss of control. Like, we're just more keenly aware of how little control we have. And I also think people have a deep, I don't want to say need, because we don't need it as much as we think, but a deep desire for certainty.
Mm, yeah, it's a good point.
I want to be absolutely certain this is going to work. We, you know, you talk about how, like, we get mad and blame people, and like, I have family in the medical community that are physicians, and people want to blame physicians. And now, don't get me wrong, physicians are humans and they make mistakes and all those sorts of things. But I think it's also easy, like, there are certain things in medical science that don't go exactly the way that they were supposed to. There's variables outside their control, but we want to be mad, and we wanted the certainty that 100% of the time this is always going to work.
Mm.
We never want to be the exception. We want certainty that nobody's ever going to hurt us, or maybe never ever hurt us again. And I think that's where I think we get ourselves into trouble. We set ourselves up, I think, for more disappointment, grief, anger, frustration, bitterness, depression, is by trying to tether ourselves to some sense of certainty when we live in a wildly uncertain world.
Yeah.
Well, and there are probably a few things you can control, which one of them I think that you're highlighting is the thing you can control is your engagement in processing the situation, whether that be your grief, your anger, whatever it is, that you can control, but you couldn't control like 99.99999999% of the things. And we ignore the thing we can, which is where I think people trade victimization for victimhood. Mm-hmm. And you end up with a 60, 70-year-old person who is still living in that victim mentality, as opposed to, this happened to me, it sucked, it's terrible, it shouldn't have happened, it was wrong, but I've processed through it, and that is, I've not taken that on as an identity, I've just marked it as an event in my life.
Yeah, well, you hit on a couple great things there. One is like, just the, I mean, in reality, the only thing you can't control is yourself. So people are going to make their own decisions regardless of what you say, even if you're a master manipulator. Like, okay, well, then that's incredibly unethical. But okay, that's that's another level of things. But going along with that is the anxiousness, anxiety, which is essentially a fear of things that may not come to pass, or trying to control things that you don't have any control over. So me being anxious about the future, and a very specific thing that I really want to happen, but there's a bajillion variables that I don't control that need to make that happen. What am I fretting about? What I'm trying to, it's almost like the fear of control or lack of control makes you anxious as well.
It's almost worse than the lack of control itself.
Well, I mean, that anxiousness, anxiety, all known people would have like sort of debilitating anxiety, like you eventually lose control in the sense of panic attacks and things of that nature that are really debilitating. My wife has gone through panic attacks that for one reason or another, like actually made her about to pass out or pass out. There was a couple times that happened, and I don't think that way. So I'm like, what's going on here? There's a lot to unpack. And in some ways, that was just like, I think part of it being a cortisol buildup, for sure. You could get into the whole flight or flight thing. And like, do you have a good outlet for that? If your outlet is just like breaking things and having a run in with the law or something all the time because you need to work through the hormonal imbalances you have. Like, okay, well, I don't know how long that's going to last, but anyways, just the, it's, I know this for myself, and I think as men, we deal with this more, where a lot of other emotions seem like, oh, those are woman emotions or something like that, or the sadness, and I need to move past it, especially if you had like boomer parents or something that was all...
Don't you cry, boy.
Yeah.
I give you something to cry about.
World War II, World War II is probably a little past that, but like Korean War, Vietnam, all that stuff, where, yeah, it's, I'll give you something to cry about. And crying is a good thing to work through. Do I want to be walking around bawling all the time? Probably not. That's a different thing. But all that to be said, it's like, I love how Lindsay described it in the documentary. She's like, emotions are like the tide. They come in, but they'll eventually go back out. And what often is, right, we hear this, especially in negotiating, don't be emotional about it, because then logic flies out the window and you're just like, I gotta buy that car because I just feel so good around it, ignoring that it's a terrible financial decision.
I'm that way about tech equipment. Yeah. It's like, no, this would make me awesome and go into the future. My wife's like, no, we have 5 kids. We need to go to Sam's. You don't need to buy a $500 router.
Yeah. No, so anyways, I don't know. It's just, but cool. I think to your question earlier, it's like, do people sit here and actually, do we encourage people to think through these things enough? Or is it just like, yeah, if we're always just, I think, encouraging people to be justified in acting out their rage, I don't think we're gonna, it's not gonna contribute to a better society, I don't believe. But
right, it's one thing to acknowledge your emotions, be aware of them, it's another to immediately act on them. Like they're data, they're a data point that should not be ignored. And to add on, and I hate the tag on sort of like corporate jargon BS, but when you were talking about men and how we handle things, and it can affect women as well, but it is easier and more comfortable for, at least for me, to be angry than it is to sit in the sadness.
Yeah.
That feels lonely, isolating, just depressing. You feel helpless. You feel vulnerable. And even if no one wants to be around you when you're angry, you somehow feel empowered or like you're doing something and you got this energy, when in real life you're not doing anything productive. It's just an illusion. Now, one thing though, and this is my poor attempt to bridge topics. One thing though, I do think that there is a lot of anxiety and nervousness about, and probably a sense of, I don't know if helplessness, that might be too strong, but maybe a loss of control or an uncertainty is around AI in general for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that I would venture a guess, there's a unique anxiety in the Christian world, in the Christian community, around AI, what it means, how it's, should it even be used, let alone how should we use it and leverage it? Can you talk a little bit about what you're finding and in your, whether it's your research or just conversations with people, and what perspective for you has started to form that makes you want to push forward into this area?
Yeah. Well, as some other software developer put it recently, he's like, well, you're taking two of the hardest problems and putting them into one, building software and religion. So my goal wasn't to come up with this like absurdly difficult challenge. It was just, I saw a use for AI in the realm of Christian faith. It started out as journaling, actually. It's like, hey, most people keep journals. A lot of people keep journals in across the board, no matter what you believe. A lot of people spiritually journal in the Christian realm, prayer journal, all sorts of stuff. The challenge there being, you rack up notebooks and you never revisit them. You don't know how you've grown through it. And so part of the sort of thesis there is like, hey, what if you could actually get insight, sort of recursive insight on that over time, to know like, hey man, five years ago, I was journaling about this thing. And look how far I've come. And look what the new and look at what the new challenges are. And so getting to have that insight, and eventually evolved into realizing that a lot of people want personalized biblical insight at the drop of a hat, but don't know where to get that. You could Google a verse, you could go into ChatGPT even, of course, and people do, but there's not great guardrails on that theologically. And I think the skepticism is certainly well-founded. What I've compared it to is the Gutenberg press. And so I think the argument then could have very well be, hey, if we allow this holy scripture to be transcribed, or not transcribed, but to be printed in mass, somebody's going to take it. They're going to screw with the messaging. And inevitably, that's going to happen. Like, it never happened before to some degree, or some translations got maybe whacked out. But let's just say that the church as a whole said, we're going to keep this to ourselves and to the handwritten copies and manuscripts, and really kind of not open it up for mass consumption. That would have had hugely detrimental effects on the sharing of the gospel and anyone else who wanted to share ideas. And so, and I think what we're going through right now is like, okay, there's this new tool that we have that can help us deepen understanding, get quicker, more scalable, perhaps, understanding and feedback, which is the path I'm on. And the challenge is, how do you do it? Well, there are problems that have to be worked through. When the when printing press started coming about, there had to be somebody who worked with the printers to make sure that the layout and all that kind of stuff was going to be up to par, such that it did not misprint things, or it did not leave out pages or books or any of that kind of stuff. Like, you would have had to really be diligent in defining a new process for what it looks like to make that happen. In some aspects, or most aspects, I don't think that's much different than where we're at now. It's a different challenge, of course. And there's going to be similar skeptics. I don't know what all the people were and what their objections were, so I'm conjecturing in the Gutenberg press time, but I'm sure you had an audience, I would assume, who was like, we don't know about this. And in some sense, do we want the masses being able to do this? Because everyone knows this, there was a certain amount of group who sought to just control people through the manipulation of interpretation over time, versus letting people read it for themselves. So, yeah, there's a lot in there for sure. Not to mention these days, the myriad of things that people, especially in Gen Z, are concerned about that you and I may not, especially if you're in just like raising a family mode, your objectives kind of get more focused. Versus if I'm like in college right now and I'm looking at all the things going on in the world, it's bananas. I thought it was crazy when I graduated in the 08, 09 time period. And I look at now and I'm like, it sucks a little more now.
And well, there's just so much more to take in at one time. There's more noise than ever. And so it's harder to get the signal from the noise. And I love the comparison to the Gutenberg press. I think in general, people fear what they don't understand. And I think a lot of people are not technologically savvy. And I don't say that as a diss. It's just not where they spend their time and what they want to be good at. They want to be competent enough to call their loved ones and maybe scroll on Facebook and send a text message or something like that. They're not trying to understand the ones and zeros of it and be on the bleeding edge or even an early adopter. But I do think people are starting to get a sense that AI is not like, oh, hey, there's like a new super fast computer thing out, or it's a new iPhone. Like, no, this is a technology that's fundamentally changing the way in which we live and work and the way humans exist currently. It's already done a lot. I think the biggest shifts have yet to come. You have someone like Elon Musk who's forecasting that in the next, I forgot his timeline, I want to say it's within five, no more than 10 years, saying that work is going to be optional. Like, just because we'll be able to do it, which, hey, man, power to you. I tend not to bet against Elon because he's a pretty sharp dude. But I think that those are massive shifts happening in a shorter and shorter time period. Mm. And so it's not like we have generations to acclimate to anything. And I think that feels nerve-wracking. But I'm with you on the like trying to combine two really difficult things like faith and technology and AI. I'm on a similar path trying to work through some things to scratch my own itch, but I'm seeing some things in the coaching consulting world that and just leadership and development that I would love to change or see an application to improve. I think the same thing about AI as I do about money within the Christian faith.
Mm.
It's amoral.
Mm-hmm.
It's not bad and it's not good. There is no evil or pure. It is a tool. Like some people like to misquote the Bible. Not some people, a ton of people. To go back to the Gutenberg idea. Yeah. But people love to misquote this verse in the Bible about like, well, money is the root of all evil. That's not what it says. Mm. It says the love of money.
Mm-hmm.
Is the root of all evil. When you exalt money, when you place money at the very top of everything, kind of like you were saying at the very beginning, is like, what's your motivation?
Mm-hmm.
That is evil. If you exalt and worship technology as like it's the savior of our age, or it's this, that, and the other thing, that's when I think you get into trouble. Instead of, let me say, what am I called to do? What am I pulled to do? What is my purpose in life? What is the good I want to do in the world? Now, how could money, technology, and other things help me get there better and faster?
Mm.
It's the same thing when I'm talking with clients and companies about, you need to figure out, and I used to do this all the time with my last company, where we were an agency, we were a HubSpot partner, and we would onboard people into HubSpot and set it all up, and then we would help them with their marketing. Mm-hmm. And they would go, well, the HubSpot can do this and this and this, and this other technology that we want to integrate can do this, mm-hmm. this, and this. And I was like, hey, time out. What is your process? Mm-hmm. What is the thing you are meant to do? Now, let's get technology to assist you in doing that at a high level, consistently, mm-hmm. and maybe faster, mm-hmm. not let's let technology and its capabilities dictate what it is we're doing. And I see people getting that reverse. And I'm curious if you see that. And then how, because again, going back to the issues of control, you can't control what users do with your platform, even with the best intent.
Mm-hmm.
But how are you trying to set things up so that this great new technology can help people in their, whether it's their journaling and their growth? Like the technology isn't their growth. You're just helping people discover it much more quickly. And one of the things that came to my mind was, as a Christian, it can be really easy to forget the faithfulness of God in the past,
mm-hmm.
right? Like a great example is the Egyptians. Like they saw these miracles. They got led out of Egypt. They saw the freaking Red Sea split, mm. which would like blow your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Like if they had emojis, they'd be all like just popping up the blown mind emoji. And then it's like days later and they're like, God, you should have just killed us in Egypt and or left us there. And you're like, are you kidding me? But we do that today. So how are you trying to leverage technology without putting it in a position where people just lead or worship it or mm-hmm. make it the thing that tells them what to do? It just helps them do more of what God called them to do.
Yeah. Very poignant question. So I've reiterated this in a lot of ways, and I'm going to continue to, is like Psalm Law grows, is that the goal isn't to make someone reliant on Psalm Law. Now, if it's a useful tool for you and continues to be, then great. But there are one of the problems I'm aiming to solve for or tackle anyways, I'm not going to solve it entirely, is isolationism. And just knowing that there are many, many problems that people are facing and they feel like they're alone. And especially like, let's say you come to the realization about something in your life, but you're not even confident your current friend group is going to be receptive to that. But then maybe you're also not even like aware of who you could talk to about that exact subject. Maybe you go talk to a therapist, which is fine. And so that's really what this is partially aimed at helping is people who are in that modality and they want to get a feedback loop and a kind of that biblical perspective. And then ultimately getting them connected into different groups or ministries or whatever it is. Let's say you've experienced prior like sexual abuse or something, then like there's a way that we can sort of understand and classify that, hey, that's a higher tier problem, and ask if the person wants to receive kind of more resources around that kind of issue where they could be plugged into a community of like faith-based recovery community around that. So that you start getting around people who and discovering communities that are going to be beneficial for you along that journey that you're on. So kind of meeting you with that life phase versus feeling stuck. And I'll be clear too. I don't think none of these things are like beyond what God can impact without my, but if it can be a helpful conduit to people discovering those things quicker, and again, coming back to just like, where does AI fit into all that? It's a tool. Like you said, it's going to be used good, bad, or otherwise. Now, like there's a lot of intentionality and testing and feedback loops that I continue to improve based on user feedback that should make that better over time. There's no V, there's no V1 that's perfect. So
that'll preach. Hell, I feel like I'm in version 4 and I myself. I'm still far from it. Well, man, there's probably a lot more we could keep diving into. These are both, everything has been really rich and are things that I think about often, which is why I was so excited when we got connected. But Preston, if somebody's listening to this and they're thinking through grief or maybe even just the uncertainty of the times, like you said, a lot of Gen Z are taking in mass amounts of data, information, news stories, some of it true, a lot of it not, but it can feel overwhelming. If somebody wanted to start to process their emotions and the uncertainty and maybe some the anxiety, what's a baby step they could take in the next 24 hours, spending little to no money, to make progress towards a healthier interaction with the world, technology, or just their circumstances?
Yeah, so there's two angles I'll take on that. One is just talk to God. Be like, God, even if you don't know who God is, be like, God, reveal yourself to me through however you see fit. But here's what I'm going through, because your problems are never beyond God. And that's a wild thing to think about. If that's uncomfortable for you, then also go get a sheet of plain paper. Go get, whether it's watercolors, acrylics, whatever it is, a pencil. And just start intuitively trying to express the frustration or sadness or, again, those things that you feel like have been bottled up. Just go through a process of putting it out there on paper, and also realizing you can throw it away after, you can put it in a drawer. It's not going to be in an art exhibit. It's for you to just process. And that's been, I think, one of the most gratifying things about the documentary in many ways, is so many people have been like, I never thought about art. It's like,
yeah,
you could do it. It's not, again, doesn't have to be some amazing thing. It's for you. So,
yeah. That's really good advice. I would have never thought about the art angle either. So that's really good. Might have to try that and then immediately throw it away so the world doesn't see it. It does make me think of a funny, it was a video meme I came across yesterday on Instagram that was meant to be like an interaction between a person and their therapist. And it's like, so I want you to, all the people who've hurt you, I want you to write out all your frustrations and letters and then set them on fire. And the reply was me. Okay. But then what do we do with the letters?
yeah. All right. I'm sure that would be
it had like a little chihuahua with like an evil look to it, which was pretty funny. Well, Preston, if people want to know more about you, more about your documentary, Psalm Log, any of your work, where would you send them? What's the best way to connect?
Yeah. So if you want to find me, I'm on LinkedIn. So you can find me there. Zellerhaus.com. That's HAUS, like you said in the beginning. But yeah, zellerhaus.com to see what I'm working on projects-wise. If you want to see the documentary, just go look up The Art of Grieving. It's going to be probably the first featured thing there. If you're in the U.S., you can watch it internationally in other places as well. But it's on Prime and Apple TV and those kind of spots. So yeah, it's good. It's a good film to watch by yourself with somebody. Yeah, those are the main spots.
Love it. And we'll link all of that up in the show notes so people can have an easy way to go and interact or connect with you and send some follow-up questions. So thank you so much, President. This was a really great conversation. I had a lot of fun. Hope you did too. And I would love to have you back in the future. We'll keep talking through some of these topics, which are maybe hard to parse, but I think are worth having.
Cool. Thanks, Kenny.
So to the listeners, thank you. So not just thank you to Preston, but thank you to you because you chose to spend part of your day with the two of us listening in. And if you made it this far, we have an immense amount of gratitude and hope that this was beneficial and a blessing to you. If it was, please like, rate, review, whatever the button of action is on your platform of choice. Take action today. Seize the day. Carpe the diem. And seize the carp, I think is what that means. But don't leave me a comment. I know what it means. I'm not that dumb. But maybe I am. But if this did benefit you, I would love to know. And if you are looking for certain topics, if you would like to go deeper on other topics, if you would like to have Preston back to talk about something, I need to know those things because even though I have a blast doing this, I make this for all of you. I want it to be valuable to you because if it's not, then why am I even doing this? I got other stuff I can do. I could probably go chase a kid or make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Sorry, it's really close to lunchtime. And as I said at the beginning, I'm very hungry. But until next time, change the way you think, you'll change the way you lead. We'll see you.